That won't.
They need to see me twice.
No, better to have the speaker view.
Yeah.
We'll live with it. I don't want to break anything.
We feel like we have a tenuous hold on the technology. We don't want to.
Oh, yeah, good point. Yeah.
Hi.
Get pronouns and pronunciation correct.
Yes, you do.
My heading is expanding.
I think you should go.
So we're good to go.
I will get out of your hair.
Thank you. When you go, can you close the back door and cut down on some of that sound?
So when audience members ask questions, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to hear it. You might need to have them on the microphone. I'm not sure. Okay.
So
So we are recording this session, and we'd like to get everybody's input on the recording. If you want to speak, you won't be on camera, but we'd like your voice, and you need to speak into the microphone in order to make that happen. When you're holding the mic, remember that it doesn't work if you hold it. You have to hold it right in front of your mouth for it to pick up your voice clearly, all right? So I'm just going to scan the camera so Raymond can see who's here. Hopefully you won't get dizzy. And there's our room.
Hello.
And we're going to keep me on the camera because Raymond said that that is helpful for him. So it's not because I'm egotistical, it's something that we've worked out. So welcome to today's workshop on Our Whole Lives in Autism, Building a Better Fit. I'm Melanie Davis, I am the OWL Program Associate for the UUA. And I have a degree in sexuality education, and I am a nationally certified sexuality educator. Raymond, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Raymond Seelove. I'm a professor of anatomy and physiology. I've been teaching anatomy and physiology mostly to students in health professions for, 25 years here at Lord Fairfax Community College and for about 5 years prior to that. I'm autistic. I have Asperger's syndrome. And I also have a son who has autism. And one of my specialty areas of expertise is the neurophysiology of autism. But because I'm also autistic, I am able to give people sometimes some insight about what autism is like from the inside, from the autistic point of view, as opposed to just from that scientific point of view. I've been teaching in religious education at the local Unitarian Church, the Unitarian Universalist Church of the Shenandoah Valley, for about 10 years, high school age, and about that long also been teaching Our Whole Lives. And summer before last was trained as a facilitator, as a trainer of facilitators for OWL 7 to 9 and 9 and 10 to 12.
Raymond, would you like to explain why we are Zooming you in for this meeting?
Oh, that's right. Well, you know, my son and I, we like to joke sometimes about the people who say things to us like, you don't look like you're autistic. And one of my favorite responses to that is, well, you haven't seen me being taken down at TSA, Transportation Security Administration, at the San Diego airport. After my wife and I did a program at ASEC, which is the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, we tried to go home, and it was just by a lot of efforts from my wife that I didn't get arrested. And she swore that she'd never fly with me again. You should understand, though, that Shelly is my wife. She's a neurotypical, which is what we autistics call people who are not autistic. And so when she said something like that, it's possible she doesn't really mean it. You might change your mind in the future. Whereas if I made a vow like that, it would probably be forever. But so far, she hasn't changed her mind.
So one of the things that that Raymond and I discussed when we were talking through this program is you know, that Raymond will be sharing some things from his very personal perspective that to help everyone here understand what some of the challenges are and some of the differences in communication and perception are. And so we felt that, you know, so you'll be hearing more personal perspective things than you might ordinarily hear in a workshop. So we'd like to start by getting a sense of who's here in the room. So can you...
could I see the audience while you're asking these questions?
Susan's going to move the camera. So you don't need your shoes. So the first question would be, how many of you are directors of religious education or running programs? Maybe hold it a little up higher. There you go. Okay. And how many of you are OWL facilitators or trainers? Ministers? Do we have any ministers in the room? Oh, we got to work on the ministers, Raymond. Parent of someone who's diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders? Grandparent? Okay, parent or grandparent? Okay. A person diagnosed with autism? Okay. Or a person who has been told you seem to have significant autistic symptoms? Okay, so one person here. Okay.
Yes.
So we rarely include questions like this when we do who's in the room, right? We kind of say, you know, we ask the first ones, but we don't ask the last two. So we might be missing out on who's actually in the room. And knowing who's in the room can help us communicate more effectively. So you might consider that. It also, you know, in addition to making communication easier, excuse me? Microphone. You can come forward, please, if you can't hear well. It also normalizes the fact that we have different ways of perceiving the world and different ways of communicating, right? If we don't make this a silent kind of issue. So Raymond's going to define some of the terms that we'll be using in our workshop today.
So there are a lot of different words that people use to describe the autism spectrum. The abbreviation ASD is probably one of the most common right now, and it stands for autism spectrum disorder. Although I personally don't like to think of it so much as a disorder, more of a difference. So sometimes when I say ASD, I translate it as autism spectrum diagnosis instead of autism spectrum disorder. The spectrum part of it is important because it's important to understand that autism has a wide range of abilities, just like people who are not autistic have a wide range of abilities. People who are autistic are just as different as people who are not autistic. There are some important similarities between people who have autism, but there are lots and lots of differences. So one of the things that I say in every one of my talks, I begin with the phrase, if you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. And that's an important thing for people to know. So I'm going to say a lot of things about myself and some things generally, but if you have someone that you're dealing with who's on the autism spectrum who's different than that, don't assume that that means they're not autistic. We're all autistic in our own way. People also often use Asperger's syndrome, and Asperger's is sometimes used to try to make a distinction to say that someone is high functioning as opposed to low functioning. Although some of us on the autism spectrum are a little uncomfortable with the labels of high functioning and low functioning, many of us don't think they do a very good job of describing who we are and what our abilities are. In a lot of ways, high functioning doesn't really mean smarter or more able. It mostly seems to mean people who are better at pretending to be neurotypical, or maybe more convincing when they're pretending. ASPIE is used a lot as a shorthand for that, and I use that for myself. But what I really like to call myself is just autistic. There's a stigma involved in autism, and when I call myself autistic, it's partly to try to claim that word and try to reduce the stigma. I've met many, many parents who have told me that I was the first person they ever met with autism who was an adult. And I don't think that's true. I think they've met plenty of adults with autism, but they didn't know that they had. And, you know, autism is an invisible disability. There are some good things about a disability being invisible, but one of the bad things is that it deprives our autistic children of role models. And they need role models. They need to know that people with autism can be successful. They need to know that we can have happy lives, that we can have families and jobs and all of the things that other people have. Autism is not a life sentence. Sometimes when I meet parents who've gotten a recent diagnosis, they act as if they've just been told that their child is dead. And it's, you know, there are certainly challenges about autism, but it's not all challenges. Some of it's really cool. And most disabilities have that sort of combination.
Raymond, when you use the word ASPIE, and
yes,
also you use I'm autistic as opposed to I am a person with autism. And I think these are things that sometimes you know, people wonder about the appropriate language to use. Can you address whether ASPIE is a term that somebody outside of the community should be using and the person first language?
Well, in the General Assembly session, I heard, I'm not sure what to call him, Mr. Barb. Is that his name?
Barb Grieve, Reverend Barb Grieve.
Talking about pronouns. And one of the ideas about pronouns is you really should respect the person who you're talking about. Their feelings about what's the appropriate word is probably the best way to go. Now, a lot of people have been taught person-first language, and the idea of person-first language is good. It says that people are more important than disabilities. But a lot of us on the autism spectrum don't like person-first language. And the reasons generally are around stigma. Again, when people use person-first language, they're usually using it to hide something that they consider a negative. So for example, if you thought that an adjective that you might use for somebody was a positive thing, then you'd go ahead and lead with it. You wouldn't say, there is a person with intelligence. You'd say, wow, that's a really smart person. You wouldn't say that's a person with beauty, you would say that's a beautiful person. And so if you put the autistic behind the person, that's essentially saying, oh, this is a bad thing that we're saying isn't all that important. Another reason people do it is to say that, you know, they'll say, I'm more than my disability. So I want to be known as me before my disability. I am not an autistic. I'm just a person who happens to have autism. The problem with that is that with autism, it is it's a neurological difference that is fundamental to the structure of my brain. You know, when people use person first language, they're often essentially saying, you would be the same person if you didn't have that disability. The disability isn't really that important. But in my case, I would not be the same person if I was not autistic. My brain would be fundamentally different. My personality would be different. And I like who I am. And so when I reject autism, or when I reject person first language for my own use, it's really a part of my positive autistic self-identity that I'm claiming for myself and for my fellow autistics. Not everybody feels that way. A lot of people are really stuck in that stigma, and I was for a long time too. I was afraid to let people know that I was autistic. I taught for many years as a professor, not wanting my students to find out that I was autistic, because I thought if they heard, then maybe they would think, oh man, you know, why did I end up with the professor who's autistic? I'm never gonna be able to. And when I finally decided, no, it's wrong for me to hide this because it deprives others of a possible role model, I shouldn't be secret about this. It turned out, as many people find when they come out of the closet, people are welcoming, people are accepting, and life is really better out of the closet anyway.
Great, thank you. So we're going to get into some more OWL specific stuff now, and if you have any other questions about etiquette or whatever, we'll have a question and answer period at the end. So what we'd like to do is build a group covenant, just like you would in an OWL class. And we'll start with sort of a standard group covenant. So what are some of the things, if you're working with a new group, that you might include in terms of how we will be in relationship to each other in this OWL setting? So what, you can call out some things that you might put on your group covenant with your participants. Use I language. So the initials that I have up here, I have NT for neurotypical. So we're going to want to do this. So use I language, okay? Okay, personal stories. And I'm going to run out of room, so I'm going to say permission, so we know what it means. Personal stories, permission, okay. What's another one? No put downs. What's another one that we might have on a group covenant? Keep your own personal space. Wait, hang on a second. Okay, what was the second one? The next one? Assume positive intent. Okay, that's probably enough for now. All right, so these are great. These are great. They're very helpful, right? But now Raymond's going to tell us how to take an ordinary, if you will, group covenant and how somebody with autism might interpret these covenants. Go ahead. So the first one is use I language.
So I language can sometimes be confusing to people on the autism spectrum. It helps to have examples. What I would probably do in one of my own classes is, you know, if you say I language, that's not going to do it by itself. The person might be familiar with that, but there's a good chance they're not. And even if they're familiar with it, there's a good chance they don't really understand it. Well, that's probably true of your neurotypical kids too. And so it would be important to gently get in and describe the difference between I language and what do we want to call the opposite, U language? So when it comes up, to actually translate back and forth between the two ways of saying something. Because it turns out that in real life, some situations it's better to use I language, but in some situations, if you use I language, you're going to be seen as some sort of soft hippie. What's the word they call us liberals? Namby-pamby. There's some cases where you really need to use more forceful language. And those differences can be difficult for people with autism to understand because we have a tendency to focus on the content of our language, the meanings, rather than the emotions behind them. And so having lots of opportunities throughout OWL to go back and forth between these different ways of saying the same thing and actually talking about the difference in the impact it has, that can help people on the spectrum start to understand how the way they say things can end up impacting how well they're accepted by others. This is a really important thing just in general, but especially when it comes to sexual communication. We're going to come back to that.
Yeah, and I think your point is well taken that the neurotypical kids might be confused by that as well. Sometimes adults are so familiar with these sort of the jargon that we don't fully explain what these things mean. So the next one was don't share personal stories without permission.
So this one can be really difficult because understanding who owns a story can be confusing. The easy thing is for the autistic to just come out of this with the rule that I can't say anything about what happened in the in OWL. And if mom says, "So, what did you do in OWL?" "Oh, it's a secret." And it's not a secret, but what will happen sometimes is an autistic student will sometimes be reluctant to share something because if they say it during OWL, that'll turn it into a secret and then they're never allowed to say it again. Does that make sense? Now, not everyone is going to have this misunderstanding, but it can happen. And so it's important to explain what it really means. Talk about the ownership of stories. If a storybook... is that barking bothering you?
Yeah. Maybe you could introduce the dog who's barking.
The dog who's barking isn't going to come and say hello. She's busy barking. I think my wife's taking care of it.
So what might be a way to phrase opinion. This in a way that is more clear?
Well, one way I like is to say your story belongs only to you. So you're welcome to decide how to share your story. But if it's somebody else's story, you're not welcome to share that.
Okay, thank you. So how about the ground rule to no put downs?
So that one could be really problematic because the emotional content of language is often the part that's hard for someone with autism to understand. Someone with autism might think they're being purely descriptive, but using words that neurotypicals generally consider to be insulting. A good example, I happen to really like the word retarded. Sorry, I know it's a horrible word and we're not supposed to use it, but as a scientist, I love that word because it means exactly what I want to say. The word retarded actually means a delay, specifically a delay in development. And I think it's an ideal description of what autism is. People will often say that people with autism can't interact socially in the way that other people do. And I think it's much more correct to say that we are socially retarded. We can interact socially with other people, but our development is slower than it is with other people. So I might be older by the time I reach the same milestone that a neurotypical does. That doesn't mean that I can never do it. It just means it's delayed. Okay, so retarded is a word that I might choose to use to describe that. And anytime I do that in a workshop, my wife jumps in and apologizes for me. That's not what I mean. Because people think of that as insulting. Well, this is the kind of thing that can happen with people with autism a lot. And so I may not have intended to put anybody down, but I might have done it without knowing it.
So this sounds like this might be related to the last one, which was assume positive intent. So we're asking the neurotypicals to assume positive intent when someone says something that they might take offense at.
So one of the really important parts, I think, of all of these group covenants is to include something about the process of calling somebody on a violation of that covenant. And that process should always include the assumption that the person who violated it really had a positive intent. And so they're not really being put down for having violated it. There's a discussion about why it's a violation so that the person can understand but not be singled out. And actually, this is something that my wife and I set up whenever we do OWL classes or OWL facilitations. When we do the group covenant, I will specifically violate one of the rules that we've decided on, and Shelley will then correct me, but show a sensitive way of correcting someone, and then I will apologize for having violated it, and then we'll move on. And by showing that process, we kind of model it for everybody else. That can help not only with making it softer for the autistic who misunderstood and thought he was doing everything right, but offended somebody. It can also make it easier for the person with autism to know, how do you call when somebody else has violated something? Because sometimes the person who's autistic ends up becoming very rule-oriented. Okay, it's gonna be my job to enforce all of these rules. I'm gonna make sure that whenever someone says something that we've decided in our covenant they're not allowed to say, I'm gonna jump out at them.
Can you give us an example? Let's say that I said something that, let's reverse roles. I say something that offends you. I don't understand it to be something offensive. How can you model sensitively calling me out?
Okay, well, so here's a good autism example. If you say to me, you don't look like you're autistic.
You look like you're autistic, Raymond.
or that, I might say, I know you don't mean that as offensive, but I experience it as offensive. And this is why it offends me. You know, when people say I don't look autistic, I think, you know, are they questioning whether or not I'm autistic? You know, I've been dealing with this my whole life, and suddenly they're just, you know, pretending it's not real. And so I talk about the reason that it ended up offending me, but making sure that I say, I know that wasn't your intent, and, you know, I hope you'll be more careful about that in the future.
So we, you know, that's a good thing to keep in mind, because, you know, very often we have to go back to our group covenant throughout an OWL program to remind people to be, you know, sensitive about sharing stories and whatnot. So thank you for actually giving us that example. There was one more on here that was
about the stories.
Yep.
Let me just say, it's a good idea anytime somebody in your group has just shared a really powerful story to go ahead and remind everyone, because the people who have autism might get into it and forget. This was one of those that was her story. Thank Nobody you. Else gets to play that one. That's hers. You know.
Thank you.
Reminders of that are really helpful.
How about the keep your own personal space rule?
Yeah, you know, the concept of personal space is sometimes really difficult to understand. For one thing, personal space varies with culture, and it varies with location. City people and country people tend to have different ideas about space. And people with autism often have a hard time understanding it. When my son, and I'm sometimes going to use my son as an example for these, my son has given me permission to share these stories. He's an adult now. And he can decide, and he actually likes the attention of me using those stories. So when he was, 5, 6, 7 years old, he really, really did not understand when he was too close to somebody, when he was, because he couldn't tell how close he was. And we actually spent in our house, we spent several weeks with everybody in the house wearing a hula hoop strapped around our shoulders, kind of like a hoop skirt, to give a visual representation of what that space was, so that he could start to picture it in his mind. Okay, if I'm closer than this, I have to get permission to get closer than this. You know, otherwise it's an invasion. And it can be really helpful to make it more concrete. Now, depending on what age you are dealing with, that might be too juvenile, but it may not be. And if there's a specific, if you're having a problem with personal space, repeating the rule over and over again probably isn't going to work. You got to find another way of making it more concrete. And the hula hoop is one way of doing that.
And I would think that that there are also neurotypical young people who have issues with personal space. So when we were talking about planning this, you had said make rules that work for everybody. And that might hold true here.
A lot of these ideas that we're presenting as being about autism apply very well to people with ADHD or ADD. In fact, there are an awful lot of similarities. Many of us on the autism spectrum consider attention deficit to be a cousin syndrome. I think eventually it will be subsumed as part of the autism spectrum, actually.
So, Raymond, we need to get moving along, but I wanted to bring up some of the other ideas that you had for sharing with the group covenant. One was that we will always post an agenda for the group meeting. Can you explain briefly why that's so important?
It's really helpful to know what's coming and how far we are. One of the hardest things with someone who's autistic is if something is particularly boring, having this feeling like, oh my God, it's going to be like this for the rest of my life. I'd like to know exactly how much longer it's going to be before something changes. It can also be difficult to change. Maybe I really like this activity and I don't want to stop. Maybe I want to keep on doing it for the rest of my life. It can be hard to make that switch. So giving warnings about when something's going to change, we're going to do this for 20 more minutes, or we've got 2 more minutes. After 2 more minutes, we're going to change what we're doing. Those warnings help me and others on the spectrum to get ready for that change. Makes it much easier. Changes that come unexpectedly are much more difficult to handle.
Now, you had also enhanced right to pass.
So, you know, we typically have a right to pass on these group covenants. But it's important to make sure that people know that they can also change their mind about passing. Maybe you decide you're going to participate in a particular activity and then it becomes too overwhelming from sensory input and you have to sit out instead. And it needs to be okay to change your mind. It also needs to be okay, like for me personally, a lot of the activities that are described as energizers are too much for me and I can't really participate in them. It really helps to be warned in advance of what the activity is going to be so that I can decide, is this something I can do? But the other thing is, sometimes I might decide I don't want to do one of these activities, and then later, after I see people doing it, I may, okay, I maybe can do this after all. And so I need to have that right to change my mind.
So the last one that Raymond suggested was take care of yourself. And this applies to both the autistics and the neurotypicals in the class. So we talked about that the autistic needs to do what they need to do, but they can only do it if they're not worried about the way it affects the neurotypicals. So can you give an example of that?
Right. So one of the things that is almost universal among people with autism is something called stimming, which refers to self-stimulation. And there are lots of different things. The classic is hand flapping, moving in front of the eyes or ears, pacing. There are lots of different things that we do. And those things are really a way of helping us to pay attention to things. When we overwhelm a particular sensory channel, it can actually help to regulate the thalamus and help us concentrate more on the things that we're trying to concentrate on. It's a way of avoiding meltdowns. And so it's important that people be allowed to do the things that they need to do. Unfortunately, some autistic stimming can end up bothering someone else. So for example, if I need to pace back and forth in order to concentrate, but I'm pacing back and forth right next to somebody who can't stand to have things in their peripheral vision, then I might actually be having one disability competing with another disability. And that kind of situation not only can bother two people, but it can also cause the person who needs to stim, it can cause that person to not stim because they're afraid that they're going to bother someone else. And so take care of yourself is not just about doing the things that you need to do, it's also about giving everybody else in the room feedback about what they're doing and how it affects you. So if I need to pace, I not only need to have the right to pace, I need to know that if my pacing bothers somebody, that that person will speak up and tell me that it's bothering them. Because if we know that that conflict is existing, then we can come up with some kind of compromise, maybe different places, maybe different ways of doing it. Maybe there's a different stim that I can do that will be less bothersome to the person. If I'm afraid that people are just going to be polite and say, oh no, it's okay, when it's really not okay, then I might self-censor myself and then not really be able to concentrate.
So one of the reasons that that's good to get all of this conversation started when we're discussing the group covenant at the very start of the class is because this sets the tone, this honest communication between the part or among the participants in the class and the facilitators that you can then continue throughout your program. So, you know, it's not a once and done thing. You want to, you know, keep your group covenant posted and keep responding back to it because that wants to keep fostering that communication.
This idea is also something that we really want people to take into their sexual lives as adults too.
Yeah.
We don't want people to just be polite and not say that something is bothering them. We want to have this open communication so that people can work out things that are mutually pleasurable and mutually workable. And this is just a way of beginning to show that.
So one of the things that Raymond and I were talking about is that in OWL, we have a lot of activities with a lot of procedures. You know, we're going to do this, 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 and this, and this. And I want you to stand over there when you're voting for this and stand over here when you're voting for this. Or we're going to make posters or we're going to cut out magazine pictures and make a collage. So we're telling people a lot of things to do, which seems okay to a neurotypical crowd. But Raymond will explain why that can be difficult for autistic youth to follow all those directions.
So one of the really difficult things for people with autism is transitions, changing from one thing to another. And so the very thing that helps to energize most of your students, your neurotypical students, can end up overstimulating someone with autism. But knowing what the changes are going to be before they happen can allow somebody to prepare for them. Is that what you were getting at?
You were talking about just the rules that for an autistic, it's hard because you want to really know what's the rationale.
Yeah. One of the important things about rules is to realize that in society at large, there are no real rules. There are just these statements of rules, but neurotypicals, when they interpret them, they always know sometimes they apply and sometimes they don't apply. And neurotypicals figure out when they apply and when they don't apply through some mysterious thing that's invisible to me, has to do with social interactions. You know, they'll get feedback that tells them, okay, this is a time when you can't disobey the rules, and okay, this is a time when you can disobey the rules, a particular rule. I'll give you an example. When you go to the state park, there's a sign out front that says no alcoholic beverages. Well, that seems like it's a rule, but once you go into the state park, you see a lot of people there drinking beer, drinking a wine, whatever. Well, if I see that, then I might assume, okay, that isn't really a rule. Well, it turns out the real rule at the state park is not no alcoholic beverages. The real rule at the park is no drunken behavior, acting like an ass. And the reason they can't have that as the actual rule that's on the sign is because then people could argue about whether or not they were drunk enough or acting enough like an ass And instead, you need whoever's in charge to be able to say, not allowed to have alcohol at all. You're violating that rule. And to the autistic who looks at that and says, well, wait a second, these other people are drinking. What's the difference? Well, the difference is you're acting like an ass. You know, it turns out that most of the rules that we have in class are violated on a regular basis. And when neurotypicals violate them, they don't get caught for it because they're able to figure out when they can do it and when they can't. The autistic sees those other kids violating the rule and thinks, that's not a rule after all. I'm going to do it too. And they do it at the wrong time, and then they're the one that gets caught. And they end up sometimes thinking, you know, the real rule in society is everybody picks on Raymond.
So how can we avoid that? How can we be proactive in terms of, in an OWL setting, you want some degree of relaxation because you want a convivial atmosphere, you know, kind of fun. But how do you balance that with the needs of the autistic youth?
Well, I think the way to do that is to be very clear for any rule what the reason for the rule is. And if a violation occurs, you need to not just say you violated the rule, you need to say why that was a problem. What effect did it have? And that's why this is there in the first place. This can be a difficult thing for someone with autism to understand, but it's one of the really important things to figure out in order to get along in society. And our church classrooms are a nice, safe place to begin to show that there are reasons behind those rules, and the reasons are more important than the rules.
Okay, thank you very much. So we were going to talk about the fact that, in the new edition of the 7-9 curriculum, there is a 15-page supplement on helping incorporate or include youth with special education needs. And it includes folks with autism, ADHD, cognitive, learning disabilities and cognitive or disabilities. So you can refer to that for some very specific tips. And it's also available, you can download just that section from the facilitator's resources area of the OWL pages on UUA.org. There's a link and you can download the PDF. There's no charge for that. One of the things that we did want to lift up is something that Raymond had pointed out, that in your OWL setting or in your just congregations in general, you might have a youth who has a diagnosis and the parents have let you know about that diagnosis. So you have some time to prepare and have discussions with the family. The other is that you might have a youth who does not have a diagnosis but says they are autistic. And you might have a youth that you suspect of having autism or being autistic, but the family doesn't want to hear anything about it. So you might never know actually who's in your group, which certainly can make life a little difficult for you. That goes to the point of having rules and procedures that kind of work for everybody. It's also important to know that as a facilitator or as a DRE, it's not your job to make a diagnosis or to guess what anyone's diagnosis is. That's not appropriate for us to do or speculate on. Raymond, we were going to talk about communication skills, both in the OWL setting and the importance of it in sexual relationships and romantic relationships. And you were talking about the activity in the grades 10 to 12 curriculum, a workshop 21.
21, yeah. This is a great activity because it really helps to separate spoken language from body language. There are activities in it where one person tries to communicate a message, an emotion, or a instructions to somebody using only their eyes or using purely body language. And it's fascinating. When I first started doing OWL and I started seeing this, I got absolutely nothing from any of this body language. It was as if the body language didn't exist at all. Now, a lot of other people found that it was really inefficient and not very good. But the thing that fascinated me watching other people do it is that sometimes people actually successfully had a message sent purely through body language. And it was a revelation to me. Oh my God, people really do this. This is happening all the time and I'm not even aware of it. And a lot of times what people do in neurotypical society is they will use their words to say something polite and then use their body language to try to indicate what the truth really is, because what they said when they were polite was actually a lie. As someone who's autistic, one of the most frustrating things for me about dealing with neurotypicals, now I should say, I understand that those of us who are autistic are really frustrating to you neurotypicals. Got that. But you all are really frustrating to us too. One of the things that's most frustrating is how much you lie. And you don't even call it lying. You'll say something nice that you don't mean and you call it polite when it's not true. It's just a damn lie. But you'll also sometimes say something mean when you don't mean it. And I refer to this as the opposite types of lying. From my admittedly autistic and fairly simplistic point of view, there are two types of lies when it comes to sexual communication. By the way, if neurotypicals lie a lot in normal conversation, as soon as the topic switches to sex, they double their lying rate, at least. So when it comes to sexual situations, there are these two opposite types of lies. There's saying yes when you mean no, which neurotypicals refer to as being polite. And then there's saying no when you mean yes, and neurotypicals call that flirting. So as an autistic, I might be, you know, maybe I'm an autistic teenager and I'm asking a girl if she wants to go to the dance with me, and I say, gee, you know, there's a dance this weekend. Would you like to go to the dance with me? And if she says, well, yes, but I'm afraid I've already got a date for the weekend, or I'm busy, I can't make it this weekend. Now, from my point of view, what she just said was yes. Because what I asked her was, do you want to go with me? I didn't ask if she could. I didn't ask about her schedule yet, right? I just asked if she wanted to. And she said yes. And then she told me something about the schedule. Now, as a neurotypical, I would figure out that she didn't want to go out with me. But as an autistic, I might not. And I might just ask her. On the other hand, if I ask, hey, you want to go out on a date with me, and she says, well, no, I don't want to go out. But as she's saying no, she's kind of, you know, flipping her hair and batting her eyes. Oh, no, I couldn't possibly. Then, you know, in my autistic mind, she just said no. So I say, all right, well, let her go ask somebody else. But she was really saying, yeah, she did want to go out with me, but I don't know, she wanted me to work harder at it.
So one of the, just explaining what I'm doing, Raymond asked me, you know, in the interest of time, to give him a signal, you know, when we're going to move on. And that might be something that you want to do with the young people in your program, to come up with a clear signal. So what we would like to do is to ask you for some examples of times when people tend to say one thing and maybe mean enough, like a white lie. So what are some of the white lies that people might say? Yes.
How are you doing?
Okay. How are you doing? Fine. Okay. Nice haircut. Okay. What's another white lie somebody might say? Beautiful baby. Barbara Walters said she, whenever she got one of those saw baby, she'd say, "That's some baby." How about a sexual white lie or a romantic white lie someone might say? You were good. Okay. Okay, so Raymond, somebody says, you know, how are you doing? Fine.
When someone asks me how you're doing, I know it from experience that they want me to just say fine. I can't do it. Because it's not true. My left foot is twice as big as my right foot because I got stung twice by a hornet yesterday and it hurts and I'm not fine. But people don't want to hear that. If somebody else tells me, though, that they're fine, I think they are. If I see someone crying and I say, "Oh, are you all right?" and they say, "I'm fine," well, good. We move on to something else.
So how about somebody says, "Nice haircut."
I actually don't notice people's hair or eyes or faces or any of that. For a long time, I wasn't sure what it was that I recognized about people, but I studied it for a while, and it seems to be more about the way people move and their vocal inflections that actually caused me to recognize people. For years, my wife would stand around making faces that made no sense to me at all, expecting me to say something about the change in her hair. And I didn't notice. And then one day she finally cut it so short it was almost all gone, and I had a meltdown. Oh my God, where's the hair? Suddenly it was too much of a change and I couldn't adjust to it.
So if somebody says, that's you're beautiful, and they're just being polite, or your kid is beautiful, or you're beautiful, or what would someone with autism really say if they didn't think that person was beautiful?
Well, that's typically when people gave me compliments as I was growing up, I argued against them. I said, no, that's all right. They'd say, "Nice haircut." And I'd say, no, I got tired of my hair being too long and I cut it myself. And my mom thinks I really screwed it up. The idea that people give compliments that aren't really true took a long time for me to understand. And it took practice, and it's still hard for me. If somebody gives me a compliment that I don't agree with, I have to pause and swallow and then say, then I go to my script. Thank you.
So
because I've been told that's what I'm supposed to say. Just say thank you. because nobody who gives you a compliment wants to be told how stupid they are for being wrong about whatever they just said about you.
So in terms of, you know, in terms of sexual interactions, somebody came up with the white lie, or maybe it wasn't a white lie, you were good.
So I really want constructive feedback because I want to be good. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be told I'm good when I wasn't. I'd like the feedback. But you know, if I'm with somebody who can't communicate that way, maybe sex is too intimate for that particular relationship. Mm-hmm. Right. And this is something that I've talked with my son, who's autistic. He has to sort of negotiate language with his girlfriends, and when they can't be clear, he can't really continue that relationship because it's just too dangerous for him.
Yeah.
If they can't be clear, if they're not willing to, maybe this is a little out of order. There's a concept. Are you familiar with the concept of enthusiastic yes? Is that something people in the audience have heard of?
Enthusiastic yes. So there's a lot of head nodding.
Okay. You know, this is very important for my autistic son because body language and words don't always match. And so we taught him when you're asking permission to do something with a special friend, if the person just gives sort of a lackluster answer, okay, maybe, then you have to take that as a no. If they say yes, but it doesn't sound really enthusiastic, he, as an autistic kid, he has a hard time knowing if that person really means it or doesn't mean it. And so he has the conversation, look, maybe you are saying yes because you really mean yes, and maybe you're just saying yes to be polite, and I've got to know the difference. If you can't say yes enthusiastically, then I have to consider it a no, because I just can't risk me misinterpreting what you want and then, you know, doing something that you don't want. That's
so there is a workshop in the new edition, the second edition of Our Whole Lives for grades 7 and 9, about consent education, and it talks about this kind of ongoing enthusiastic yes. And so, you know, I think it's one of those things that you people learn through repetition, so you don't want to just say it in that one workshop. You would want to continue mentioning that and reinforcing that as you go through. Raymond, one of the things that we discussed that you wanted to talk about, because it's a behavioral, a classroom management issue, if you will, is the runaway associative thinking process.
Runaway associative thinking is one of my favorite parts of being autistic. My mind tends to jump from one thing to another in very quick succession. And this is true of most people with autism. What it often comes out as in a classroom situation is you might be talking about one thing and your student may then say something that to you seems totally off topic. When I'm talking to my wife, she often has to back me up and say, Raymond, I didn't get the connection. Can you back up and fill me in on the missing links? Because sometimes I think so fast, I can't put all those links into words. That often happens with your autistic or ASPE students who are really interested in the topic, and they might think of 100 different things that are related and move from one thing to the next and miss some of the in-between things, and what they finally blurt out may seem to you totally unrelated. And you might interpret that as the kid having no idea what's going on or trying to be disruptive. And this is another case where it's best to assume good intentions. Assume that that person with autism has a reason for what they said and ask what that reason was. Ask them to fill in those missing gaps. My wife, who's a therapist who specializes in autism, she finds herself often doing this with her clients. And whenever she asks them to fill in, she ends up getting really good insights. And it's because she trusts that the insight is really there. It is there. Those kids are smart. They're thinking. And they're not trying to be disruptive. A neurotypical saying something off topic might have done it specifically to disrupt class because they thought it was funny. Those of us on the autism spectrum, we can't figure out what somebody's emotional reaction is going to be to what we say. We say it for our own internal reasons, not because we're imagining what it will do to disrupt the class. And that can be hard to believe.
We wanted to get to empathy building among peers, but because we only have about 15 more minutes, a little less than 15 minutes. But I did want to get to one of the points you had said is that sometimes somebody who's autistic will look like they're not paying attention. And you can misinterpret that as they're bored and they're just not here, but that can be their way of processing the information, right, Raymond?
Yeah. I had in my class a nonverbal autistic man, so somebody who people who use the high-functioning, low-functioning language would have called low-functioning. He was invited to come and sit in my college-level anatomy and physiology class, very difficult class, because I wanted to just see how much he could absorb of it. Mostly he was only kept in other classes that weren't very stimulating because they didn't think he could benefit from them. But when I talked about very complex things, I could see him reacting. One of his ways of stimming was to sort of mumble back and forth to himself. He'd have a little conversation with himself. And what he was doing was processing the information that I was giving. He actually got a lot out of it. If I hadn't known what was going on, I might have thought he wasn't paying attention because he wasn't looking at me. He wasn't looking directly at the charts that I was showing. And I might have thought he was talking to somebody else, or he was talking to himself a little bit. But that was what he does in order to pay attention. If he had been looking straight at me and being completely quiet, it would have taken all of his concentration just to do that. And there would have been none left to actually pay attention to what I was saying. If I insist on proper schoolboy behavior, sitting still, looking at the teacher, not fidgeting, it might take so much energy for somebody on the autism spectrum to do that, that they then can't actually pay attention to what's going on. And the one that's kind of looking away and fidgeting, that may well indicate that they are getting it. And if you have someone who's nonverbal, don't assume that they're not getting it. Don't assume that they're not absorbing the information. There are many, many times when people who have become verbal late in life through assistive technologies, it turns out they were absorbing it all along. And you got to assume that's the case.
So Raymond, we have 10 more minutes. I'd like to leave 5 minutes for questions. So, or more if we can, but can you just go over some of the things that the facilitators can do to help build empathy among the neurotypicals for their autistic peers?
I'm checking my notes here on which of the things that I've talked about. Well, one of the suggestions that I had was talking about the difference between direct language and polite language. Because direct language is a lot easier for me to interpret, I kind of prefer it. Sometimes it's nice when someone says something direct that sounds impolite. You know, you'll teach them how to convert the language into, maybe you'll take something that sounds too confrontational and turn it into I language. And that might be a usual thing that you do in class, but it might be a good idea to do the opposite also. When somebody says something that's really polite and not very direct and doesn't get at the real meaning of it, obviously, to step in and say, you know, that's a polite way of saying that, but can we translate that into a more direct way of saying it? And to introduce the idea that there are different ways of saying things. Sometimes you can say the same thing very politely or very directly, and direct might be considered impolite, but polite might be considered vague. And there are different situations where these different things might be useful. So if you get in there and help translate both directions, then that can help the neurotypical students to be more direct when it needs to happen. And it can also help the autistic students to understand there really are different ways of doing this. And if my direct speech isn't working, maybe that namby-pamby polite stuff that I learned in OWL will work better. And I can give that a try, see if I get better results.
And would it be helpful if there were some dialogue about, maybe at the beginning of the OWL program, about potential stimming behaviors that they might observe? And, you know, what's the etiquette around asking questions if someone's doing this and you don't understand why they're doing that?
Yeah, well, you know, you can always ask why somebody's doing it, but a person who's autistic doesn't always know why they're doing it. They might only know it feels better. It helps calm them down. They might not even be able to put that into words. So sometimes you might have to help out with that. There is neurology involved. Gosh, if you could give me another hour, I'd love to.
Next year, Raymond, next, or we'll do a podcast about it. But I mean, would it be reasonable for that conversation to happen? Like, you may see me doing X, Y, or Z, or you may see your peer doing X, Y, or Z.
And this is, it would be good to have this conversation with parents beforehand, what sorts of stimming behaviors are likely, and maybe even with therapists. It's a good idea to have a team. You know, if the person with autism has a therapist, you might want to confer with that therapist at some point, get some ideas about things that might work, but also let the therapist know what's going to be going on in OWL. And one of the things could be, you know, get an explanation for some of these behaviors. Not all autistics will want to talk about their autism, but the ones who do encourage them, because if they can talk about it, especially in a positive way, with a positive autistic self-identity, that can help other people to understand. And when I have a chance to explain why I do something, it makes other people much more tolerant than they would otherwise be. Not everyone's going to be willing to do that, but when they are, definitely do that. Ask permission, though.
Great. So I'd like to offer people a chance to ask. Good, you're convenient. You're right here to ask questions.
Hi, Raymond. My name is Kim Jackson. I'm a member of First Unitarian or First Universalist Church of Denver. I self-identify as Aspie, but I've never been officially diagnosed. And a lot of the behaviors that you talk about are actually very insightful for me. And looking through this, it's like, oh, well, that's why I did that. And it's making more sense. The question I have for you, I identify as asexual. And I'm aware in the asexual community, there seems to be a large proportion of people with autism spectrum disorder. And I was wondering, with your background in physiology of autism, if you had any insight into that.
Yeah, absolutely. There seems to be a disproportionate number, not only of asexual identified people who are on the autism spectrum, but also of transgender people who are on the autism spectrum. And I've discussed this with a number of different people, some of the specialists at Johns Hopkins. And there are a few different theories, and I think perhaps all of them have some truth to them. One of the theories is that people with autism are less likely to make decisions on the basis of what other people do. Instead, we tend to make decisions about ourselves and the way we live based on an internal logic that makes sense to ourselves. So for example, I might decide to wear a dress, not because I'm a female and females in this society are expected to wear dresses. I might decide to wear them because I like the way my legs move in a dress better than the way they move in pants. And so I might make a lot of decisions that end up not really corresponding to my gender in the way that people expect it to. And it may have nothing at all to do with an expression of my gender. It might never have occurred to me that that would have anything to do with gender. Or if it occurred to me, I might have thought it was stupid. Why would people dress that way just because they have a particular gender? So it may be that we are less likely to just take society's word for what we're supposed to be and do it. But there's also the idea that maybe some people who are on the autism spectrum feel so different from everybody else that they may latch on to any identity that seems to explain why they are so separated from other people. It's often the case that people on the autism spectrum have an easier time finding partners in foreign countries or from people from foreign countries. And part of the reason for that is because people from another culture are more caretaking. They will just accept any mistakes that you make as being because you're from another culture and you just don't know. And it's probably not because I'm from a different culture. I wouldn't know if I'd grown up in your culture either, but because they're more accepting. And so one of the theories is that maybe women are more caretaking with a trans woman, thinking, this is somebody who didn't grow up as a woman, so they kind of need some more explanations. And so they might be more nurturing. Maybe sometimes the trans community is a place to find an easier acceptance to someone who's different. So I guess my real answer is, I don't think anybody knows why the disparity, but it's definitely there. And I think these various explanations could have something to do with it.
Our time is up. I'd like to invite you, if you have any other questions, Raymond, would you like them to email them to me and I'll forward them, or would you like to give your email address?
They can email me. Emailing me would be fine. Raymond Selove, RamonSelove. Do you have?
Yeah, it's at the bottom of the screen. His name. Yeah, it's RamonSelove at Comcast.
So
Is it comcast.net or .net?
Yeah, comcast.net.
If you didn't catch that, you can send a question to me at owl@uua.org, and I'll certainly forward it on to Raymond. Thank you very much, Raymond.
Thank you, Melanie.
Thanks for coming, everybody.
Thank you.
Say hi, bye.
So, Raymond, you want to talk on Monday?
Thank you. Yeah, Monday would be good.
Okay.
You'll be back home on Monday?
So I'll send you an email.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
You're very welcome.
So cool when everything works, especially when you didn't think it was going to.
Well, boy, I was in.
Unexpected.
Yeah. It certainly woke me up. I was feeling a little sleepy, and then all of a sudden, adrenaline was pumping.